All right, it's Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. This week, we've got Nick Jamay on, co-founder of Sweetgreen. Nick started the company in 2007 with his classmates at Georgetown, Nathaniel Rue and Jonathan Newman. They literally graduated college and are like, all right, we're going to open up a cool, fast, casual salad joint. And next thing you know, they've got like 87 locations across the country, 4,000 employees. They got a music festival. And so I was just kind of curious, like, Nick, how the hell did you do all this from running the business to sourcing, like, sort of really choice prime ingredients across the country from local farmers? Why do all their shops look so cool? A lot going on with that brand, and we talk about it all. But before we get to that, I also want to mention Nick will be joining us on June 9th at our Healthy-ish Homecoming event here in New York City. It's an all-day festival of talks and food and exercise, all sorts of good stuff. We're having everyone from, who do we got on? We got Jenna Wortham, New York Times writer and co-host of the Times podcast, Still Processing, Cookbook Dynamo, Allison Roman, Grammy Award-winning actress Cynthia Erivo. They have Chef Reem Asil from the Bay Area coming out. We're going to have food by Botanica out in L.A., Two Hands here in New York City, Little Deb's Oasis upstate in Hudson. It's going to be a really fun, awesome day of sort of, you know, all things wellness-related. So check it out. You can buy tickets at healthyish-homecoming.com. That is healthyish-homecoming.com, and it is on June 9th here in New York City. And after Nick and I talk, we've got Peter Meehan, writer and former editor of Lucky Peach, RIP. He reads an essay he wrote for our June-July grilling issue called The Barbecue Pit. All right, here is Nick and me. Let's do this. So, Nick, I was in the shower this morning thinking about you. and I was like, all right, what are we going to talk about? And I was kind of going through my mind all the things about Sweetgreen and how you sort of run a business, obviously. And I was like, okay, you got the real estate deals you got to worry about. Mm-hmm. Got to get that right or else nothing works, I imagine.
Agreed.
You've got the operations in terms of like, how do we get all these salads out the door really quickly, or people, especially New Yorkers who are impatient, are like, well, I'm not coming back there.
Mm-hmm.
You got personnel and hiring, a lot of turnover in this industry, right?
Yes, there is.
You've got design. You guys have set a high bar where, like, if I walk by a Sweetgreen nowadays and if it doesn't look really cool, I'm like, eh. Like, what's up with that?
Yep.
The food needs to be good.
That it does. The most important thing right there.
Maybe it's the most important thing. I don't know. And also, you're also dealing with all these perishable ingredients that, you know, if I get an avocado in my Sweetgreen salad and it's not like perfectly ripe. And you also have established a mission as a company in terms of doing good for the community, sort of how food is sourced and grown and all that sort of stuff, and the relationship with farmers. And you guys are also, I kind of feel like you're not from Silicon Valley, but you're a sort of tech in touch company.
Yeah, we're a tech enabled business.
Exactly. And you guys have to be on top of that. And tech is constantly changing.
More important than ever.
Were you ever like, oh, my God, what did we get ourselves into when you guys started this when you were like 23 years old?
You know, when we started Sweetgreen, it was pretty simple. We didn't think about any of that. We didn't know where it would take us. But we were just trying to solve a problem for ourselves. Every single day in college, we were sick of eating the same kind of junk and decided we would build a place ourselves that fit our values and made us feel good. And most importantly, had food that made you feel good, but also create a brand around it that would celebrate that food.
And you went to business school. So you at least had an idea of what it takes to run a business, any business, correct?
We did go to undergrad business school.
Oh, no, it's all right. You're a business major, I guess.
Business major. So we Sweetgreen, you could say, is our business school.
But and so you opened in D.C., your first one in Georgetown, was it in?
In Georgetown, right on M Street, right off the campus.
Okay. And having grown up in Washington, D.C., that's not cheap real estate there. What made you think that was a good idea out of college? Like, oh, we're going to open a business in like the most sort of posh area in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Selling salads.
I would say we thought it was a good idea because we didn't really know that much. So the naivete, I guess, helped make it a good idea for us. But the first space was tiny. It's 560 square feet, and it's still there today. And we lived around the corner from it as seniors in college. So we saw this little former little tavern. I don't know if you remember the little tavern burger chains from D.C.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It was a former little tavern. And it was,
for those who haven't been, little tavern is kind of like White Castle, little steamed burgers.
A dollar burger sack.
A little green roof sort of. Yeah. They're awesome.
So it was one of those, and it had been sitting empty for years. And so we said, perfect, we'll just take it. We didn't know that opening a full scratch cooking restaurant in 500 square feet was near impossible. We didn't know that there wasn't the right utility. I mean, we just didn't know anything. So we just went after it, and we made it happen.
But, okay, first of all, being business students, you at least did the math of like, all right, if we're going to be paying, what was the rent when you first opened?
$3,000 a month.
$3,000, wow, that's cheap.
Yeah.
What's the rent like in Flatiron District up here or Meatpacking District?
A much scarier number.
Like what? Give me a number. Like 30,000? 40,000?
It can be anywhere from 30 to 50,000.
Yeah. A month?
Yes.
Okay, that's insane. So in D.C. at least.
For a much bigger space, though.
Yes. But so what was the math you did? Like, all right, how many salads do we need to sell a month or a day in order and dealing with overhead and food costs and personnel? Like, what did you kind of figure out? I assume you did this.
Yeah, we wrote a whole business plan with a, you know, worst case, medium case, and best case scenario and understood how many we'd have to sell. And to be honest, out of all the Sweetgreens we've opened in 10 years, it was the one we had the least worries about because we were building it for ourselves. We knew that this is what we wanted every day, that our friends, that our girlfriends, that our, you know, fellow students. And we were almost just thinking about the Georgetown community to start.
Did you think that students would go there?
Yes.
Do students walk off campus at Georgetown?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And they come from good enough means that they can afford like a nice salad.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. And so those first few months, how did it go better as planned, worse as planned? What was that biggest hurdle?
It was between the medium case and the best case. So it did well from day one.
What was the biggest food challenge? Like what ingredient posed you the most headaches?
Good question. You know, it started simply in the beginning by us just going to the farmer's market and trying to explore what sourcing, you know, these kind of local and organic ingredients would be. And because it wasn't at scale, it wasn't that challenging. We were just sourcing for one restaurant. The challenge in the sourcing really started to happen when we had 4, 5, 6 restaurants because we couldn't just load up, you know, a couple cases from the farmer's market and bring it into the restaurant. We had to figure out how we were going to create a system around this.
There's a lot to go through here, but one thing you have done is you've established a mission of sorts, and you talk about it on your website and what you strive for. In terms of food, and we can get to community and staffing and stuff also, but in terms of food, like what's optimum, what is acceptable, you know, given the constraints in terms of what does that spectrum go in terms of supplying all these restaurants?
Yeah. So for us, you know, when we started Sweetgreen, it was pretty simple. We just wanted to connect people to real food and not just create access to it, create a place where you could easily get healthy food that you trusted. But the two most important things for us that we actually were trying to create was make healthy food taste good, so make that craveability, but then also just make it cool. You know, when we started Sweetgreen, we looked around and the most delicious food, the most celebrated food, the most accessible food, the coolest food was all the least healthy. And so for us, when we looked at, you know, eating food that made you feel good, had a branding problem. Yeah. And it had a taste problem. So those were it sounds silly to say that, but that was kind of what we set out to solve.
All right, you didn't answer the question, so I'm going to get back to you on that one. But I will say this, it's interesting how you are sort of at the beginning of that wave that where nowadays healthy food is cool all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And I think you guys were certainly a big part of that sort of cresting, and you have websites like Healthy-ish and stuff that are sort of, so much of their MO is that sort of cool, stylish factor, and like, oh, this is sort of, I don't want to say trendy, because that's a little demeaning to the food itself, but it's sort of very of the moment and feels current. Whereas I know when I was growing up in the 70s, the notion of going to a health food store was just depressing.
Exactly.
Again, but the food, though, so like, where are you getting the food? Like, what, you know, all right, we're not going to do Sisqó, but we will do this. Or like, obviously, you have so much, you move so much product every day.
Yes.
Especially in a New York, what's your busiest New York City store?
There's a couple. Bryant Park, Nomad.
Okay, so Bryant Park is right by 42nd Street in sort of Times Square, Midtown Manhattan. Mm-hmm. How many salads a day will you sell there?
I mean, anywhere between 2 and 3,000 a day.
2 and 3,000?
Yes.
A day?
Yes. I mean, it depends on the day.
But in one location?
Yes.
That's insane.
Yeah,
okay.
People love healthy food now.
So that's, I have no idea. How do you supply that store?
Yeah. So the way our supply chain works, and this has evolved over years because every year we get a little smarter, we learn more, and we figure out how to do this at even a bigger scale. And every city, we're in 8 cities now, 87 restaurants, and every city is its own supply chain. So it's this idea of regionality and seasonality. And so for us, it's about understanding what makes sense for each region. Who are the farmers? What are they growing? What's the soil like? What do people eat in that region? What is indigenous to the soil even? Trying to understand all of those inputs. And our supply chain team, we have about a 6-7 person supply chain team, spend their time in the field connecting with farmers and growers. And we have a whole 100-point grower ethos that we go through to decide how to source from them.
Two questions. So then, are there certain salads that are available in certain cities that aren't in others due to what's available around there?
Yeah, so in all 8 regions, we have our core menu that is, you know, sourced from small, medium, and large size organic farmers. But then we have a seasonal menu that is based on those regional inputs. And that changes 5 times a year based on the seasons. And in different cities, there's different salads.
Okay. So are you dealing with farmers directly like, hey, salad guy, we need however many thousands of heads of romaine a month. Can you do that for us?
Yeah, so the relationship is direct with the farmers. And that's part of the model that that is different for us than a lot of other restaurants at scale, is we work directly with the farmers, small, medium, and large. And it's not about going to your distributor and saying, I need local cucumbers, find them for me wherever you can.
Yeah.
For us, it's about finding the farmer, understanding how they're growing it, what they're growing, what seed they're using, what they're doing to the soil, all that. And then we use our distributor as a great partner to move those boxes around.
But then you're also, but there's obviously, there's certain things you're not getting locally that you've got to get flown in. And and then how do you deal with that? Are you dealing with farms directly, or are you dealing with some central distributor who can sort of access you the things you can't get locally?
Yeah, so we have direct relationships with some of the largest organic growers in the country. So our lettuce, for example. Lettuce is part of our supply chain that needs to be pretty stable. We can't, you know, one day not have lettuce in your restaurant. Otherwise, we won't be able to open. So we work with some of the larger organic growers, and they supply all of our regions. So for us, it's like a yearly contract with them, trying to understand and even just look at our volumes for the year out. So a lot of these farmers, we work with a year out to plan what they should be planting, what they should be harvesting, at what price we're going to pay. You know, it's really about like contracting the stability of the supply chain.
What ingredient provides you the least profit margin? Like people, you have to have it on your menu, but you're not making any money off it, basically. That sort of thing.
On average, I would say the most volatile ingredient has been avocado recently because of the avocado apocalypse or whatever you want to call it. That's what we called it internally. But
yeah, what was the price swing in terms of what you were paying for those
guys?
Oh,
it went from, you know, what we were paying to like 6 times what we were paying per case. So it went up like sixfold, yeah.
And what? And when was that, in what span?
Man, it was last year. I believe it was in the fall.
Has it gone back down to what it was?
Yes, it's gone back down. I mean, and there's you could do a whole podcast on avocado supply chain between Mexico and California when the California season ends and you transition to Mexican growers and the way things are grown down there and some of the labor issues down there. So it's a much larger issue, but it results in a shortage here in the U.S., or it did last year at least.
What percentage of customers want avocado on their salad?
I should know this. I think it's between 25% and 35%.
Yeah, if you said 75%, I'd believe you. I feel like in America, like everyone wants avocado on everything now.
Sorry, so I would say 4 out of 10 of our core salads have avocado in
it.
Okay, I'm thinking of the custom salads. But yeah, probably 40% to 50% of our salads have avocado.
Yeah,
on them.
And then how do you ensure that those avocados are ripe every single day for every single salad?
Yes. So there is a process with the distributor of when they get them, and there's like ripening rooms, so they only ship you the ones that are ripe. When the shortage
happens. But you don't want them too ripe.
No, there's a perfect point of ripeness, which they send them to you. We get delivery every single day, sometimes twice a day in some of these busier restaurants. So it's about the product you can use that day.
Wow. That's insane. All right. I'm going to totally change subject. Got a lot to talk about here. Mm-hmm. You, Jonathan, and Nate, 3 partners.
Yep.
Which of you three, at the time of launch, or maybe after the first one, was like, oh, we need these restaurants to look cool. They need to be really well designed.
I would say that's definitely something the three of us always agreed on. And even to my point before, part of what we wanted to do was rebrand this type of food that made you feel good, but just create a cool environment that you wanted to come into, that you chose to go spend your money at, to go buy your lunch or your dinner at. And the way the physical space makes you feel is very important.
So who gets sign off on design? Because design is a very subjective issue. And what one person thinks is cool, someone else might not agree with.
Yes. I would say overall, the three of us are pretty aligned on our aesthetic and design taste. It's evolved over the years, just like our stores. And that's kind of intentional. we don't want our restaurants to look like they've been stamped out or they have, you know, a certain look. There's a certain energy or vibe we want in the restaurants, but they should feel and look different in different cities and different neighborhoods. Every couple of, you know, every 5 or 10 restaurants, we hire a new architect just to get re-inspired and think about where the design can go. The design team today reports to me, so I probably spend more time on design, but Nate and John are both very, very involved in it still.
When you say design team, how many people are on the team?
We have a 4-person design team.
And they'll deal with everything from graphics to...
Yeah, from merchandising to graphics, a lot of the marketing team does, but everything from furniture to, you know, the lighting plan to acoustics, everything.
It all matters.
Yes.
Who does the playlist?
The playlist. We do that ourselves. We have a company that helps, like a system that actually distributes it by restaurant. Nate, my co-founder, spends the most time on the playlist, I would say.
What do you guys argue most about? Or what's the one? What's a recurring point of source of an argument? Because I know you guys must argue about something.
We do. We argue. Well, you know, I would say at a time it was the playlist. We used to argue about what to put on the playlist. But yeah, I mean, it's more just like, you know, healthy debates. I'm trying to think about the last thing we argued about.
You say healthy debates. You mean that figuratively, or you mean that literally about what's healthy or what's not healthy?
No. Well, I guess both. No. Figuratively, it's you know, the fact that there's three of us. It's nice because it becomes a triple filter. When one person has an idea or we have to make a decision, it's, you know, one of us might just take the point of devil's advocate just to bounce the idea around and make it better. And so we've never, you know, we rarely like aggressively disagree on things.
What have you been wrong about?
A lot. Yeah, I would say, you know, I think being wrong about things and failing is something we embrace at Sweetgreen. And if we're not getting things wrong, we're not trying enough things, or we're not trying hard enough. Things I've gotten wrong, everything from, I mean, even like thinking about certain locations or certain things on the menu, or, you know, really every day I'm wrong about something.
Have there been instances where something has worked out much better than, since you sort of said this is not going to work and then it ends up working, you know, that your partners were behind and you weren't?
Those kind of things happen every day to all of us. I think whether it's what real estate we're picking, where one person, you know, there was like a few sites in New York that on paper didn't look good when we wanted to sign the lease. And me being from New York, I'm like, trust me, guys, this will work.
Yeah.
Same thing in LA with John and Nate. So sometimes this deeper, nuanced understanding of the decision or the problem, it's kind of like the art and science. Sometimes the science doesn't look good on paper, but if you know it in your gut with your experience and the art, you can make that decision.
Have you guys closed any locations since you've launched?
We have closed one because the lease was up in McLean, Virginia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was, out of all of our restaurants, it was the poorest real estate decision. Not the city, but just where the actual site was. It was kind of hidden. You couldn't see it. The parking wasn't great. And so there was just not great awareness of that.
And that's one of those locations where everyone's in a car. I mean, my sister lives in McLean.
Yeah. And it did fine. We could have kept it open, but we just decided lease is up. Let's probably close it and maybe look for something else in McLean.
Community-wise, I mean, obviously one key of sort of successful real estate is finding neighborhoods that are sort of evolving, gentrifying, et cetera, in terms of getting a good deal. And then on the flip side with restaurants, that restaurants receive some criticism is that they open in these neighborhoods, but then they don't sort of serve the community that has been there for a long time. How do you guys deal with that in terms of both customers, staffing, et cetera? And again, this is something you guys talk about in terms of a mission and building a community, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so for us, and we look at our mission, which is just connecting people to real food and building healthier communities. You know that there's a linear way you can take that, where it's where we build our restaurants, the food we serve, how we source our food, how we support the farmers in the community, you know, even how we show up with our team members. Our team members learn a lot about healthy food and they get to eat it for free every day. And today we have almost 4,000 team members that do that. And so that actually, if you look at it, is one of the biggest impacts we make. But it's also in a much more dynamic way, looking at the effect we can have, not just in the conversation of real food and how we're, again, making this kind of food cooler, you know, something people actually want to engage with, creating that desire for it, but also understanding the impact we can have in the community outside of our four walls. So we've spent a lot of time on certain food access projects in every city we're in.
Which means what?
So really understanding the parts of the city that need, that don't have any access to healthy food deserts, if you want to call them, and trying to create solutions where we can then feed them. And so in a few cities, Chicago and Boston, we've created mobile markets where we take old city buses that the city has given us and decommissioned and turn them into mobile farmers markets. So fully outfit them, brand them, put refrigerators in them, and connect with a farmer and a group that will actually source them and run them all day long. So in Chicago, we have a bus, and in Boston, we have a bus that actually goes around and feeds anywhere from 30 to 50 different neighborhoods in a day.
Wow.
And then in LA, we took a freestanding convenience store that had basically been a liquor store called Hank's Mini Mart. And spent a year and $100,000 turning it into a healthy market. And it just opened about a month ago.
And where is that?
In Inglewood.
Okay. That's where the Forum is, correct? Yes?
In that general area, I think. I'm still fairly new to LA. I'm learning.
Never been to a concert there. We'll Google that. Anyways. Speaking of concerts, as if you guys didn't have enough to do running this multi-pronged business with all these headaches, not headaches, but challenges. Mm-hmm. You decided, like, oh, we're just going to start a music festival, music and food festival, because, like, why wouldn't we want to do that? What the hell were you – I don't get, like, how – what made you think, like, that was a good idea or that you could actually accomplish this?
Yeah, I think that's –
which you have.
That's the right question, because at the moment, it really is, like, what the hell are you thinking?
Yeah.
And we had no business doing it, and, you know, on paper, we should have focused on the business, but
– Sweet Life is called, by the way.
Sweet Life Festival. But at the moment, you know, as we saw this conversation around food just – progressing and getting cooler and cooler, we knew we wanted to engage with our customers in this conversation in cooler ways. So using music and this, you know, what we think is the most experiential, you know, element, like a music concert, a festival, and how we could use that to talk to our customers about food and just have a really fun day. And usually that day that is the most fun is usually the least healthy. You know, you ever seen what you eat at music festivals normally?
Yeah.
And so it started really simply with us just playing, you know, popping up a table and DJing outside our second restaurant, Sweet Green DuPont. My co-founder, Nate, is a DJ, or used to be at least. And we just, that store wasn't doing that well, our second one, so we decided to DJ outside.
How was that? And DuPont Circle, that would see, all right, going back to real estate, that would seem to me like nice neighborhood, a lot of workers around there. That would seem like such an
obvious
location.
It's a great neighborhood. We were on the wrong side of the block that hadn't opened yet. So we were the first to open on that side.
Where are you on Connecticut?
It was right on Connecticut. Uh-huh. So everyone was on the other side, and we were on one side. It was the old Riggs Bank at the time, which is now full of people. But we just needed people to see that we were there.
To turn up the music.
So we blasted music, you know, without a permit, just did it every weekend, and it started to work. Then behind us is the DuPont Farmers Market. Our kitchen door literally opens onto the DuPont Farmers Market. So we decided to have a concert with 100 people. Then 3 months later, we did it again with 500 people. And then we decided, okay, let's do this in a much bigger way. And Hot Chip was coming through town, so we got them to come and DJ, and we had our first, you know, quote-unquote festival with 1,000 people in the parking lot there.
And what sort of permits and stuff did you need for that?
We got permits for that one. We built the stage. I literally had to go around to the neighborhood getting signatures from anyone that lived within 500 feet. I still have the clipboard.
So how did you sell them? Like, hey, we're going to have this, like, Euro techno sort of party band come perform loudly.
It was a community event. There was food. There was activities.
It was from what time? What time did you?
It was all day on Saturday.
But by nighttime, it was shut down?
Yeah, by 7 or so.
And what did you do food-wise?
Sweet Green food, and then we had a bunch of our partners, like, you know, Nick Wiseman in D.C. came and did something. Our folks from Lululemon were there helping people learn how to do headstands. You know, it was just a funny, it was really, really bare bones. But then from there, we met the guys that own 930 Club and Merriweather Post Pavilion, and we were talking about doing a much bigger one, like 2,500 people.
Yeah.
And as we were looking at venues, he was like, what are you guys doing? Let's just do this at Merriweather. I have everything built in. You don't have to build any bathrooms or stages. And he said, make me a list of the artists you would want to see. We're like, all right, cool. So we make this crazy list of like Jay-Z and Phoenix and, you know, Daft Punk and and The Strokes and, you know, this whole list. And he comes back 2 weeks later and he's like, The Strokes are interested. They're coming out with a new album. And so that was The Strokes.
What year was this?
This was 2010 or 11. 11, I think.
Okay.
So it was right when that new album came out and they hadn't played in D.C. in 6-7 years. And so, you know, we booked The Strokes and then we sold 13,000 tickets. So we went from in a parking lot to 13,000 people at Merriweather Post Pavilion.
How many bands total?
Eight bands.
And that was, again, from what time to what time was that?
It was an all-day festival. Okay. Yeah. And over the years, it's gotten bigger to 2-day. And at one point, we had 25,000 people a day when, you know, Kendrick Lamar and The Weeknd and Calvin Harris. And
I mean, I love ideas that start small and grow naturally as opposed to like, oh, we need to make money and what's our business plan? So there was an organic business-ness to this idea, but now it is a business. And is this like profitable for you, or is it more of a branding exercise, or what is the point in your mind of Sweet Life now?
Yeah, the festival for us was never, you know, meant to be a business. It was always meant to be part of the community, way to just engage people in the conversation on food and just make it cool. So as we were building this big festival, we'd also take over concessions and replace all the food and, you know, a lot of the junk with not just healthy food. You know, we don't want people eating like salads all day at a festival. Yeah. That's not realistic. But, you know, if someone was going
to
have
I don't want a fork when I'm at a festival. I don't want
it needs to be
fork.
Handheld.
Yes, I want handheld.
So we'd have everything from like, you know, the Rappahannock oyster guys to if there was a fried chicken sandwich, it was someone that was sourcing chickens the right way, getting rid of soda as much as we can, just bringing in good food from farmers and chefs and just the food you should be eating.
Do any Sweet Greens have
fried chicken?
No. Well, you should. Beer and wine license?
Not today.
What would that entail?
You know, it's different in every city and every neighborhood. Mm-hmm. There's different rules, so it's definitely something that we've talked about. And I think having a nice glass of rosé with your salad at night or for lunch on a Friday would be great.
Yeah, given well, especially it's interesting now. I feel like that industry, community, whatever you want to call it, with between the craft beer movement mm-hmm. in this country, that's now. If you look at the beer cans and stuff, like cool and fun and hip and has a very high design sensibility, same with the natural wine movement. It feels like that would make sense at a Sweet Green.
Absolutely. It's something we've talked about.
And I hear selling liquor is profitable also. Seems like it'd be a good business move, wouldn't it?
The margins, I hear, are good on alcohol.
What's interesting, I'm just thinking about a neighborhood like Bryant Park, which is almost exclusively businessy in terms of mm-hmm. office buildings. Let's take this one up. There's one about 10 minutes walk from here at World Trade in Tribeca on Greenwich Street. Mm-hmm. What is the, do you know the percentage of business you do lunchtime compared to dinner time?
That one is pretty heavy lunch because the office building across the street.
Okay.
And I believe that one is, you know, 60-40.
Are there any locations that do as much dinner traffic as lunch traffic?
Oh, yeah. A lot of them. I mean, our restaurants are fairly busy at dinner in general.
Eating in or taking out?
Both.
Yeah.
Funny enough, a lot of it is fitness driven. So if you look at where our restaurants are, they're close to most fitness things, SoulCycle, Equinox, yoga studios. And if you go in at night, if you notice, more than half the people are going to or coming from the gym.
They're wearing their outdoor voices.
They're wearing their outdoor voices.
Lululemon or whatever.
That's
yeah.
right. More OV, I would say.
Interesting. So, I mean, it's funny. I mean, and I imagine you probably have a high percentage of diners are solo diners. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think if you think about the value proposition of Sweetgreen, of, you know, if you're eating alone, if you're a solo diner, of like going home and assembling this thing for one person, you have to buy a whole package of lettuce, a whole thing. It's like the actual economics and the work for one person versus making it for a family of four.
Yeah. I'm terrible at, and something I always struggle with is food waste. And mm-hmm. if you're buying a bunch of ingredients and you want to make a Sweet Green-esque salad, you're buying 9 different things. You might use like a quarter of the head of cilantro that you bought, and then you're going out the next 2 nights, and then you've got friends come, whatever. And then all of a sudden you look in the fridge and you've got this wilted head of cilantro a week later, and you're like, oh.
Yep.
And it's like, yeah, I can go there and spend less money and get a better version of what I probably would have made at home.
Yeah, that was kind of the idea of Sweet Green, was to remove the friction from eating this kind of way and just making this food more accessible and easy. And for us, even as you look at how technology has changed the transaction, today almost 50% of our transactions happen on our app.
Oh, wow.
So that's people ordering ahead or paying with it or whatever you want, but it's this idea that it's just convenience.
Yeah. Oh, getting back to the beer and wine. see, if you have beer and wine on the menu, then I think you'd get like more sort of couples and stuff coming to Sweet Green for dinner.
That's a good
like
point.
Date night, Emma? What do you think? Emma's like, yeah, baby, you know.
I think date night at Sweet Green sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, you know, maybe see a movie and then like the suite, because then like I don't have time to go see a movie and have like a whole hour and a half dinner.
Yeah.
If you kind of do the math, but movie, 30-minute dinner,
like
glass
that.
Of wine at Sweet Green, all of a sudden you're talking. You know what you can also do? Now there's a lot of cool, I'm just giving you all sorts of advice.
Please,
this is
free. Keep it coming.
There's all these cool canned wines out there. Like, that would be cool also.
Yeah, yep, like a nice Ramona with your salad.
Yeah exactly. Yeah. Come on. Gosh. You need any investors? You have lots of investors. You said 87 locations now?
87 locations today.
5 years from now, how many domestic locations will there be?
A lot more, hopefully. But for us, the way we think about it is less in number of restaurants going forward because, again, the way people are transacting with food is changing quicker than ever. So, you know, for this year for us, the focuses on demand and delivery. So thinking about, it's less about how many restaurants we have and more how many customers can we serve.
Does it make sense to have delivery-only properties that you don't have to trick out with the design and a desirable high-rent location?
That's exactly part of the plan, yeah.
And you would have those, you could have several of those in a city as large as New York and depending on the
especially in super dense areas in a place like Midtown, I don't need to open 10 restaurants in Midtown. I can open three incredible, beautiful Sweetgreens that are flagships and then have a delivery function that, you know, can just bring the product to you wherever you are.
Again, and that gets back to tech.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's so fascinating. I mean, again, the salads better be tasty. There better be some tech application that I can easily access it that mm-hmm. has all my information. You've got to deal with real estate concerns and when it makes sense to open a retail version versus a delivery version. What's next on your plate? Do you have anything? What's in terms of other than opening another Sweetgreen? You've got the music festival. Is there anything else happening that we don't know about that you're sort of a new area you're forging into?
Yeah, I would say for us, you know, we're at the tail end of our, we do a lot of chef collaborations and just in general artist collaborations, whether you're a chef, musician, or artist in our restaurants. And we just are in the middle of our Nancy Silverton collaboration, okay. which for me has probably been one of the most exciting ones we've ever done.
And Nancy's a chef out at Mota in LA. So collaboration, what is that? And you have those cool t-shirts with her on it.
Yeah.
But what does that entail? What does a collaboration mean?
Yeah, so for us, it's finding chefs that are like-minded, that believe the same thing in food that we do and that source a certain way. And Nancy for us is, you know, a queen among chefs. And she's what she's done for not just California, but, you know, bread and vegetables, and she's just created a whole new culture around eating this kind of way. And so we created a salad with her on the menu called the Nancy's Chop Salad, which is actually just a version of her famous chop salad. So as we thought about, you know, any kind of salads out there that have existing equity, Nancy's Chop Salad or some version of that chop salad is one. So we wanted to celebrate that and bring those flavors onto the menu and then just celebrate her, have a lot of fun with her. So we had a bunch of fun dinners and parties. And like you said, we put her face on a t-shirt and I wear it once a week. So
I have it at work. It's in my closet at work. Nick Jermaine, thanks for stopping by. And we will see you at the Healthy-ish Homecoming All Day Fest. Yeah, so it's June 9th here in Brooklyn, and you can buy tickets for this awesome all-day fest with, like, speakers and food, and you got Nick Jermaine and all sorts of other interesting people in the kind of in the healthy-ish community. It's going to be awesome, and you can buy tickets at healthy-ish-homecoming.com. All right, thanks, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
If the canopy of stars wasn't so captivating, wasn't like silver glitter spilled on velvet the color of midnight, I might have just given up. It was the kind of damp that turns your bones to glass. A spell of 40-degree weather rolled in on what should have been a swampy summer night, and we'd been outside since the previous afternoon, on a patch of grass, ringed by mountains, huddled around the smoker for warmth. I was cooking in my first barbecue competition in a small town in the Catskill Mountains, and seeking shelter would have meant letting my buddies down. Other, properly prepared teams were asleep in their trailers and trucks, shelters festooned with Old Glory or InfoWars stickers. So onward towards dawn we shivered, checking the schedule and our prep list and debating when to switch from beer to coffee. It could have been anything, I guess. Old cars, ceramics, maybe an interest in flying small planes. Entering middle age, perhaps looking to distract myself from my feelings about how my business partner had shut down the mildly artsy food magazine I edited, I fell into cooking over live fire as a life filler-upper. I became a guy who was into barbecue, which, for as true as it is still somewhat painful to type. Talking heads had told us that day was coming when you wake up and ask yourself, well, how did I get here? For the past few years, my family and I have been getting out of New York City on weekends and during the summer to go to an old bungalow encampment in a hollow pinned between a swamp and a graveyard. It's our little slice of heaven with trees and a big lawn and other kids for our kids to play with. There are six other families there, and we, whoever's up from the city on a given night, routinely eat dinner communally, a dozen or twice as many people sitting down. A whole pork shoulder or all the ribs they had at the supermarket can disappear without anyone even contemplating seconds. The big annual party, which predates me, is a Labor Day pig roast, when everybody's friends and friends of friends cover the lawn in a patchwork of picnic blankets, bring side dishes or desserts, and make sure their kids don't drown in the pond. Over the course of a few summers, I went from being a willing helper to spearheading off-season discussions about how we do next year's pig. Now I initiate get-togethers that necessitate the cooking of whole animals whenever possible. Because, like anything I've ever been into, I need to up the ante every once in a while to get the same kick. It's one thing to cook competently for your family, and it leads, often, to cooking for friends in grander quantities. It was another thing when all of this led me to enter a barbecue competition. Actually, I would have vaguely committed to it, forgotten about it, missed registration, and gotten on with my life if it were not for Jonathan Hooper. Jonathan is a fellow dad at the Upstate Place and the property's founding pitmaster, a guy who is active on Reddit barbecue boards and has a real job in life. Over the years, as we've gotten to know each other, we've undertaken a consistent and escalating program of barbecuing bigger animals, or more of the little ones, and the competition felt, in some ways, like a natural next step. We'd been inching towards the cliff's edge. It was time to jump. I wasn't unafraid. I am insecure about my cooking in a performative sense. I am a writer, not a cook. I have no investment in the value of trophies, diplomas, and their ilk. My interests lie more in regional barbecue, the ribs or shoulder or brisket cooked over wood you get at the place down the road, than in the style practiced at competitions, which is a thing apart. While there are many governing bodies that put on barbecue competitions, the Kansas City Barbecue Society is the big dog. KCBS says it sanctions 500 meets a year, from backyard-only competitions, where pros are excluded, to invitationals, which require you to have won a trophy to qualify. Four types of meat go before the judges: pork butt or shoulder, pork ribs, beef brisket, and chicken. The scoring rubric the judges are educated in via a one-day seminar is intended to be region-agnostic, as welcoming of vinegary Eastern North Carolina pork as of salt and pepper Texas beef, but it is not. Rather, it rewards what's often called competition style, a groupthink simulacrum of many styles. Competition barbecue is sweet and saucy. It is pretty in a manicured post-World War II food styling fashion, uniform and tidy in a way that most real barbecue isn't. The aesthetic prescriptions about how the meat should be presented are campy enough that I think John Waters would dig them. From the rules, prohibited garnishes are lettuce cores, kale stems, and other vegetation, including but not limited to endive and red-tipped lettuce. To summarize the difference between regular and regional barbecue styles in KCBS BBQ, I draw this comparison. In one, you're hosing off your mutt in the driveway. In the other, you're scissoring perfect pom-poms on your purebred's haunches before trotting him around Westminster. The kind of chicken that wins competitions is fashioned from skin-on but boneless thighs, tucked into taut little bundles, the final product lacquered in sauce. Jonathan and I apprenticed ourselves to a bearded YouTube guru named Tom Jackson, aka Chef Tom, to dial in our chicken and ribs game. And it was following him that we finally assented to some of the more arcane practices of winning barbecue. We removed the skin from the thighs, scraped the subcutaneous fat from its underside, then redraped it on the meat after it had brined for 90 minutes. The quantity of honey that Mr. Jackson drizzled over and around his ribs was gratuitous, if not something more unseemly. We ignored our own moral compasses and played along. This is what the competition gods wanted, so we spent a few weeks of the summer gearing up for that kind of cooking. The cynical, carpet-bagging, Yankee egghead reason I cooked at the dog show was so that I could call it a dog show without feeling like someone could snipe me for saying I'd never shown a dog. But just like you don't stumble into owning a show poodle, I wasn't cooking in the competition by accident. I find myself wanting to be out there by the woodpile, by the collection of pits that had grown like the lawn furniture of a nightmare neighbor, the one who starts with one car up on blocks and soon enough is hoarding mounds of unclassifiable trash in his yard. Now my neighbor Jonathan and I are that guy, but for meat cookers. I acknowledge that humanity has collectively been trying to improve on cooking over fire since the first monkey man synapses fired in frustration, asking, geez, can we speed this up a little bit? I know the Instant Pot is the dream that humans disperse themselves around the globe seeking, not the chance to spend another night tending fire with a whole dead animal on top of it. But I grew up in the suburbs and I've lived in cities ever since, the kind of cities where having a space for a grill is unlikely. So now I can watch a fire forever, in a pit, in the wood stove that heats our cabin. My kids roll their eyes when I tell them about the colors in the fire, the whites and the blues and what they mean, but then I see them coloring the fire in their drawings with those pencils, hues I never reached for in my Duraflame youth. I'd buy albums of the fire's hisses and pops to listen to in my city apartment. The roar of a bonfire? The way its heat pushes you away before you realize the warmth of the day has retreated and there are bats overhead and suddenly you want that sear on your shins, that orange glow turning your cheeks red? Yes, please. I liked that cooking over fire was uncertain. Writing cookbooks, I'd spent years developing a facility with other kinds of cooking that I could be assured would turn out. I know most of what a wok does on a home stove, how a 12-inch nonstick pan heats up, how long it takes to melt onions. But for a few years, I didn't know how the meat would turn out, how the fire would behave, if we'd be conquering heroes or idiots who'd burned or undercooked dinner. It was fun, which is a dumb and easy word, but an elusive feeling at certain times in your life. The competition was held on a field Honus Wagner is rumored to have played some baseball on in a Catskill mountain town called Fleischmann's. The townsfolk, now mostly Hasidic Jews, eyed us as we drove in, and I noticed we didn't have the matching t-shirts or gleaming five-figure rigs that many of the other competitors did. We had a rented U-Haul pickup and a rickety but beautiful Texas-style smoker I bought off of Austin barbecue godhead Tom Micklewhite. And maybe it was all those weekends full of meat play, those 3 a.m. wake-ups, all the YouTube video watching and looking at cookbooks, but I found myself caring a little bit about winning something. Maybe it was not wanting to return home looking like schmucks, or wanting to at least be schmucks who had some hardware to show for it. Maybe it was the fact that I've never won an award for anything, despite being in a business that gives out a lot of medals. When judgment was ready to be meted out, all of the deliberations and score calculations happened in private. The competitors gathered in a semicircle in front of a tiny stage as the organizers went through the categories, doling out trophies and cash prizes. We'd undercooked our ribs. We pulled them too early, and they weren't as tender as they should have been. And our decision to dress our pork shoulder in the vinegary Eastern North Carolina style was a recipe for losing against the ketchupy confectionery style more proven to win. And we got buried. So it was all riding on chicken and brisket. I was confronted with pride and creation while sitting there, something I feel congenitally averse to. But our chicken was good. My teammate Mark Eibold deserved to win something. He's not a barbecue idiot like I am, but he had dutifully and beautifully scraped the underside of the chicken skin clean in the early morning and had done an exceptional job as our lettuce fluffer, creating gorgeous and rules-compliant carpets of greenery to present the meat on. We had been educated in the style of Texas barbecue by Micklewhite, one of the finest practitioners of the form, so we imitated his brisket as well we could, but shellacked the burnt ends with the sweet sauce in a way that I could imagine our other chef Tom, the one from YouTube, revving his Harley for. Teammate Seth Prouty, also a civilian, had meticulously stoked the fire and split wood quietly in the dark as he shepherded the meat towards doneness for more than 12 hours. Royal Hooper, Jonathan's then 11-year-old son, rounded out the team. He was there for some sort of father-son bonding opportunity, but rather than be pressed into indentured servitude as I'd hoped, Royal succeeded mainly in showing how much better he was at sleeping than the rest of us. When, early in the morning, the event organizers apologetically parked the generator for a mechanical bull right next to our tent, there's a carnival aspect to some of these competitions, but that all gets underway after the serious cooking has happened. He goosed free rides for himself on it for the rest of the day. Still, we sent Royal up to collect our trophies. Third place in chicken, second place in brisket. In a field of 17 competitors, these were victories, and the couple who ran the competition couldn't have been kinder or more complimentary about our finish when we visited the tent to claim our prize money. They said that placing as we did in our first pro competition was a guarantee we'd be back for more. It wasn't, which isn't to say we won't. There wasn't a gregarious community of like-minded cooks, or the chance to expand our minds tasting other barbecue that is part of the promise of most food get-togethers. The hours sucked, and the pay was bad. But we didn't abjectly fail. We didn't lose any toes to frostbite. There was a moment of cow scratching herself against a fence post satisfaction in the molten yolk of an egg and cheese sandwich that warmed us as dawn broke, and another of revelation when a pan of pork scraps, water, and salt transmuted itself, as teammate Mark said it would, into a pan of carnitas, meat snacks to fish out with dirty fingers as the competition drew to a close. It was this, an excuse to gather around the fire, to cook with friends, and to do funny things to meat, possibly for praise. It wasn't the best of times, but it wasn't the worst either.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.